American Cassette Ministries is pleased to provide you with another presentation from the 2005 General Youth Conference in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Thousands of committed Seventh-day Adventist young people came together as an army on a mission to proclaim the three angels' messages to the whole world in this generation. They believe now is the time.
Good morning. Welcome to the seminar on religious liberty and last day events. Usually you start a few minutes late to let the place fill up, but this morning we're full early. What a tremendous conference this is. There's many seminars going on this morning, and to see this many people up and ready at 9:30, I suppose many of you were up and ready at 6 o'clock. I understand that's when the first meeting was. So welcome to the morning sessions here on Thursday. My name is Nicholas Miller, and I will be leading out in today's presentation. I need to introduce myself, so I will do that. I am an attorney. I am presently at Andrews University, where I have come in the last year to open up a church-state study institute at the university and at the seminary. And in the very near future, we will be offering certificate programs as well as master's and eventually doctorates in church-state studies, church history and theology with an emphasis in church and state. There are a number of positions in our church. Most unions have religious liberty directors. Certainly the divisions do. And many conferences have leaders who wear multiple hats, one of them being religious liberty in church and state. It's an area that is only going to grow in importance, as we realize from our study of, both history and more importantly, prophecy. And I have been a student of both for many years, and now I'm being sponsored to do a Ph.D. in church history to go along with my law degree, and I'm in the middle of those studies. And it's a fascinating time to study the roots of the American Constitution, as we see events of constitutional significance unfolding around us. Not just constitutional significance, but prophetic significance. And we are going to talk about that, about American history, about prophecy, and about the sanctuary. And there's going to be three related presentations. Each will stand on its own, but they'll build on each other. Two will be this morning, and then one will be this afternoon when we tie it all together and focus especially on religious liberty, and the sanctuary. Let's bow our heads and pause for a moment of prayer this morning. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this new morning and this new day, another gift of life, another chance to learn about you and to grow in your truth and to serve you, to learn to serve you more effectively. And I thank you for this great gathering of young people who have an interest in eternal things, who want to prepare not for this life, but for the life to come, most importantly, and to share that with their friends, with their loved ones, and with our society, with our country at large. I ask that your Holy Spirit be here with us, that it open our minds to special truths for this time, that we may gain a deeper understanding of your call for our lives and the role that we can play in these important days that we now live in. We pray these things this morning in Jesus' name. Amen. So, just to introduce myself a little further, perhaps, I was a student at Pacific Union College a few years ago, back in the 1980s, and then I went off to law school. I developed an interest in church-state matters there and religious liberty and went off to law school, and then spent about 10 years practicing with the government in private practice and with an advocacy group in Washington, D.C., lobbying for religious liberty on Capitol Hill, appearing in federal courts, including the Supreme Court, for religious liberty cases. But ultimately, my goal was to associate with one of our institutions and teach Christian young people to have faith in the Bible and in prophecy and learning more about religious liberty. And so that's what I'm doing now. And I think technically I was a young adult until about 2 or 3 years ago. I think that runs until 35. But I was reminded this morning that there is a new generation coming up. I was walking down the hallway, and I saw a young man, a serious-looking young man, with a shirt that said, "You know what your problem is? You're stupid." And I thought, yeah, maybe that is my problem. There's a certain honesty about the younger generation these days. They don't beat around the bush. There's a certain, you can't fake a lot and get away with it. And I suppose that's not all a bad thing. And especially in the times we live in now, people are looking for real answers. They're not going to put up with cliches. With statements that we believe this because we've always believed this. That's just not going to fly. And I think that's truer in society at large since September 11. People are looking for real answers that involve universal truths and right and wrong. And this morning, I'm glad to report that this topic of religious liberty, the Adventist prophetic understanding, I think is more true and more real and more relevant than it ever has been before. I'm convinced that in the past our church has sometimes approached religious liberty as though it's sort of a bunker in Montana. This is something we're doing to protect ourselves in the last days, so we won't lose our jobs about Sabbath. Or perhaps we use it as a kind of alarm clock, a last days wake-up call. But it's especially for us so we understand the urgency of the times we live in. Now, both those things have their place. I've represented people in Sabbath cases to prevent them from losing their jobs because of their religious convictions, and that's important. And it's also important to be aware of the times we live in, and if we see prophecy being fulfilled around us, the Bible gives it to us for that reason. But I think that religious liberty has an even larger role in those two things, and that is religious liberty is the ultimate last forum whereby the world is warned and the principles of right and wrong, of conscience, are brought before the public. And the spirit of prophecy talks about this. The Bible talks about this, how in the last days you will appear before kings and rulers. And I'm sure that some of that is going to be fulfilled in Christian young people standing up for truths of religious liberty in public forums, whether it be in legislatures or in courts. It's the ultimate last ground for witness and for advocacy. And I think that the Adventist message, the three angels message, as well as the sanctuary message, as we will unfold it, plays a special relationship to religious liberty and gives a special opportunity for these distinct truths to be heard. This first session, though, we're going to talk about the general current of church-state affairs in America. Where are we at now with the Supreme Court? We have a Supreme Court justice that's retiring. A new one will be probably confirmed next month, although the hearings will likely be contentious. But as long as the Republicans control Congress, I suspect that that Samuel Alito will be confirmed, although nothing's a given. But what are some of the issues that will be raised? Why should we care about it? And what prophetic significance, if any, does it have? How does it relate to a larger conflict that's taking place in our culture? I want to begin to set a context with a quote from The Great Controversy, where Ellen White specifically identifies two principles that are of central importance to our country and to our nation. She says this: "Republicanism and Protestantism became the fundamental principles of the nation. These principles are the secret of its power and prosperity." It's in Great Controversy, page 441. Republicanism and Protestantism, the two fundamental principles that are the basis of the success and the power that our country has had. What are those two principles? What do they stand for? Well, she doesn't leave us to guess. She actually brings them out in the two sentences that are written before this, and I'll read that. The first is this, where she sets out republicanism. "The Constitution guarantees to the people the right of self-government, providing that representatives elected by the popular vote should enact and administer the laws." If you want to put it in a memorable phrase, you can do no better than Abraham Lincoln in his Gettysburg Address. Republicanism is essentially a government by the people and for the people and of the people. It is a government that is responsible to and at least indirectly administered by the people. Now, Protestantism. Freedom of religious faith was also granted, every man being permitted to worship God according to the dictates of his conscience. And if you read elsewhere in the Great Controversy, it becomes clear that Protestantism, the principle, at least when it relates to the civil government, has to do with the conscience being respected. If you think about a democracy, democracy is ruled by 50% plus one. The majority has the right to have their way. But if we lived in an unbridled democracy, that would be a disaster. You'd have a mobocracy. Whatever the majority wanted would go, and there would be no individual rights. So how do you balance the theory of democracy with individual conscience? Well, that's where Protestantism came in and said, yes, you can have a democracy in most areas, but in a small area dealing with the conscience, with individual rights, the majority shouldn't control that. The protest of the princes in 1529, in matters of conscience, the majority shall have no say. And this found its way into our jurisprudence through the Bill of Rights, which is essentially a check on democracy, where one judge can stand up for one individual and say, no matter what everyone else thinks, this man's or woman's conscience shall not be infringed. And they can strike down laws that have been passed by the majority. So these two fundamental principles, republicanism and Protestantism, the basis of America's power and prosperity. So it would be a concern if those two principles were threatened, were undercut, were diminished. And this morning, I have to report to you that both those principles are facing significant threats and risks. And I can speak just briefly about republicanism because the focus this morning is on Protestantism. But over the last few days, just to take something from the headlines, you've probably been made aware of the controversy over the surveillance of American citizens by the executive branch. And it came as even a surprise, even with this administration and its poor record on civil rights, it still came as something of a surprise that they would carry out this secret surveillance program. And then when it was discovered, instead of backing off and apologizing or claiming they didn't have knowledge of it at the higher levels, were unapologetic about it and said, we're doing this for America's best interests. We will continue doing it. You can't stop us. The level of... I need to place this in context, I suppose. There are specific laws passed by Congress which detail under what circumstances search warrants, surveillance can happen. And search warrants need to be obtained under almost all circumstances. And there's a secret court that can be applied to. It's a very easy process to undertake. The warrants are rarely ever turned down. Thousands are gotten every year. And for the executive branch to create its own exemptions to laws that are passed by Congress is to fly in the face a fundamental violation of our constitutional system, where the laws are made by the people's representatives in Congress. And the president is meant to enact those laws. And at the heart of every republic, that must be the case. I have a cousin who grew up in England and has lived here for 7 or 8 years, a very learned fellow, studied at Cambridge and is now here in America. And he said, I can't believe what I'm seeing. I feel like I'm back under a monarchical system. This is King George III all over again. And it's almost, the principle involved is almost more important than the outcome. I'm not sure who was surveilled and what information was found, but for the executive branch to stand up and say, we don't have to abide by laws of Congress if we don't think they're in the national interest, is a fundamental violation of Republican principles. It usurps your rights as an individual, and you should care about it, and you should be writing to your representative saying, we want our Congress respected as the ultimate representation of the people. This is only the latest example of an attempt by the government to either ignore Congress or ignore the courts. And I suppose we're seeing that play out in these series of cases, Hamdi and Padilla, accused terrorists who are held without court hearings. And it's not that maybe these are bad people. I don't know. But we have systems and processes in place where that should be determined. And what concerns those of us who care about civil liberties is not that these people are being held, but the way they're being held, with an insistence that Congress doesn't need to set down the procedures and the courts don't need to review the holdings. And that's very, very concerning for people who care about civil liberties. Most of this doesn't have directly to do with religious freedom, but if you want to vindicate any right, including religious freedom, you have to have access to the courts. And if the access to the courts is being denied, then effectively all your freedoms are being denied. And we should care about these things, even though we're not Islams or most of us aren't from the Middle East. That's why the American public has been so relatively quiet in the face of most of this, because it's happening to an unpopular minority. But who knows who can be an unpopular minority in the future. Now, I will have a question and answer session at the end for the last 10 or 15 minutes, so if you can save your questions until that point. Threats to republicanism, we should care about that. We should write our representatives. But I want to look more closely, because it's more related to our concerns, and that is threats to Protestantism in America. And I want to spend a few moments looking at a case that's part of our title here this morning. I talked about the Supreme Court and the Ten Commandments. And last summer, many people, it's always a rumor in Adventist undercurrents that there's a Sunday law pending or about to be introduced in Congress or maybe even passed one of the houses. And I have to tell you this morning that that's not true, or at least I know nothing of it, and neither do my friends in Washington who monitor these things very closely. But it is very interesting that the whole Ten Commandments went to the Supreme Court last spring, and a decision came down early in the summer. And that decision reveals a fault line in the Supreme Court and in America that is very, very important, and that tells us where we are as a country in relation to religious liberty in an extremely profound way. The Ten Commandments cases, there were two of them. And we're going to look a little bit at the opinions in those cases, because it shows that the court, the Supreme Court, is divided basically into three sections. There is a left wing to the court. There are some folks on the court who I might call them secular relativists, secular constitutionalists. People like to call them perhaps judicial activists. They believe in an evolving, unfolding constitution, and they want to base their jurisprudence on the latest sociology and psychology and not so much on what the founders believed or the principles of the founders. This side of the court has been outside the mainstream. It has been marginalized on the court. It hasn't had much power on the court since probably the 1970s. There's two or three members on the court strongly in that camp. But the right wing of the court has been much more important, and the right wing of the court I describe as moral absolutists. They strict constructionists. They're focused on original intent. If it's not in the Constitution explicitly, then it's not there at all. The words separation of church and state aren't in the Constitution, so the founders couldn't have had it in mind. Our founders were religious and Christian, so they wouldn't mind if we honored our religious heritage. That's the right wing of the court. Now, fortunately, the story of the Rehnquist court is that the right wing of the court never fully was able to take over. O'Connor and Kennedy in the middle. O'Connor, one of the most clever and influential Supreme Court justices probably ever, in the way that she's managed to hold the center of the court together for the last 10 or 15 years and prevent Scalia and Rehnquist from fully implementing their extreme views. And so we have the centrists, I view them more as principle seekers. They use original intent as a guide. They want to understand the founders, but they use it merely as a guide to the unfolding of principles. If you have a judge and you always know how that judge is going to come down on any case, I think you have a judge who's an ideologue rather than a true judge, because the art of judging is understanding existing principles in new circumstances. And you can never figure that out ahead of time. And people used to criticize O'Connor for not having a philosophy which would always decide a case. But maybe that's a good thing. Maybe you should wait to see what the facts look like under the principles and have an open mind to what the outcome will be. Of course, both sides on the left and the right view the center as sort of unprincipled, pragmatic compromisers. But I think they have it wrong. I'm going to read these two cases. The Ten Commandments cases that came down came down separately depending on which case you looked at. You remember there was a case out of Texas involving Ten Commandments on the state capitol grounds there in Austin, and that display was upheld as being constitutional. And the court went into an analysis about there were 30 or 40 other monuments on the grounds. It was in a setting with other displays, historic displays. It had been there for 30 or 40 years. No one during that time had apparently been particularly offended by it. I'm not sure if that's the right analysis on that, but they decided that it didn't rise to the level of a government endorsement of religion. Nobody would be viewed as an outsider because on this large ground with these many statues, there was a Ten Commandments a statue. They found the reverse in the Kentucky case, where the statute had been placed on the wall in the recent past. It had originally been placed there alone. It clearly had a religious intent to it. After the fact, they'd added some other historical elements to it to sort of disguise what they'd done. But the court sort of saw through that disguise. And so I think this was the best decision they could have reached. Because can you imagine if they'd struck down both the displays, the headlines in the morning paper would essentially be the Supreme Court vetoes the Ten Commandments. And can you imagine the backlash there would have been politically and socially in our country? It would have been a very bad thing. If they'd upheld both displays, it would have been given a great deal of leeway to the religious right and to those who want to bring religion into the public square. So I think they did the right thing in arriving where they did. But the opinions themselves are very revealing. And I'm going to read to you an opinion from Justice Scalia, which represents how the right side of the court views matters of church and state. And he was writing here in the Kentucky case, where the commandments were taken down. And Scalia strongly disagreed with that. And these cases, as I'm remembering, were decided by 5-4, so they were very close cases. And this is what Scalia says in his dissent. The three most popular religions in the United States, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, which combined account for 97.7% of all believers, are monotheistic. All of them, moreover, Islam included, believe that the Ten Commandments were given by God to Moses and are divine prescriptions for a virtuous life. Publicly honoring the Ten Commandments is thus indistinguishable, insofar as discriminating against other religions is concerned, from publicly honoring God. Both practices are recognized across such a broad and diverse range of the population, from Christians to Muslims, that they cannot be reasonably understood as a government endorsement of a particular religious viewpoint. You hear what he's saying there? 97.7% of all believers are Jewish, Christian, Muslim. Notice how he's choosing his statistics very carefully. He's not saying 97% of all Americans, but of all believers. So he's narrowed his group, and then the biggest, by far the largest portion of that group fall into those three camps. And because all that large group believes in a God, we can honor God in our country publicly without infringing anyone's religion, really, because you don't really count the 2.3% on the margin. And because they all believe in the Ten Commandments, our government can honor the Ten Commandments publicly and endorse them. Because so many people believe in them, it's not really an endorsement of religion. So what's his test for determining whether the government can support a particular religious view or not. It's if enough people believe it, we can promote and endorse it, and it doesn't violate the separation of church and state. So what does that say about Protestantism? It's just the opposite, isn't it? Protestantism says the majority in matters of conscience, they shall have no say. Well, Scalia is saying here, well, as long as you've got enough on your side, then they can have all the say they want. I contrast that with what Justice O'Connor wrote. When the government associates one set of religious beliefs with the state and identifies non-adherents as outsiders, it encroaches upon the individual's decision about whether and how to worship. In the marketplace of ideas, the government has vast resources and special status. Allowing the government to be a potential mouthpiece for competing religious ideas risks the sort of division that might easily spill over into the suppression of rival beliefs. And notice this sentence in importance. I think this was written directly to Scalia's point. It is true that many Americans find the commandments in accord with their personal beliefs, but we do not count heads before enforcing the First Amendment. Nor can we accept the theory that Americans who do not accept the commandments' validity are outside the First Amendment's protections. She understands what Protestantism is about, what our constitutional system is about. And yet, she and Kennedy are viewed by the religious right as the most dangerous, compromising justices in America. And the religious right would hold up who? Scalia? They want another Scalia. They want another Rehnquist. That's who they want on the court. Completely misguided. Completely misguided. Here's Scalia concurring in the Texas case. He always has to say something. He wasn't in the majority opinion, but he had to get his two cents in. There is nothing unconstitutional in a state's favoring religion generally, honoring God through public prayer and acknowledgement, or in a non-proselytizing manner, venerating the Ten Commandments. Scalia would have the government venerating the Ten Commandments. Now, if you thought it wasn't possible to be any more extreme than Scalia, I introduce you to Justice Thomas, who wrote, essentially, at least Scalia would apply the First Amendment, badly, poorly, but at least he would say it applies. Justice Thomas says, I have previously suggested that the First Amendment's text in history resists incorporation against the states. If the Establishment Clause does not restrain the states, then it has no application here, where there is no only state action at issue. Justice Thomas would argue that the First Amendment only applies to the federal government. It never was meant to apply against the state governments. Therefore, the First Amendment, instead of preventing states from promoting religion, actually protects them and allows them to establish religions if they want to. Utah can be a Mormon state, and South Carolina can be a Protestant state, and New York can be a secular humanist state. So he just wouldn't have it apply at all. Now, these cases were decided 5-4. The important votes, Kennedy is still there, but O'Connor, swing vote, is resigned and is retiring and will be replaced by, it appears, Samuel Alito. And he will be the fifth Catholic coming onto the Supreme Court, which is rather remarkable. If you look at the history of the court, about 10% of the justices have been Catholic. So at any given time, one justice might be a Catholic. And then suddenly in the last 15 years, they've gone from about 10% of the court to 58% of the court, which is extraordinary. Now, this, what Alito will do, he actually is slightly better than Scalia. He will protect religious minorities. He favors a free exercise clause. Scalia threw that out a number of years ago. But Alito is very soft on the Establishment Clause and on the separation of church and state. And it is of real concern that he will be the fifth vote, which will swing the court strongly towards the Scalia-Thomas view of the separation of church and state and religious freedom. There was another case this summer that showed the sort of, hypocrisy as well as an interesting divide on the court. There's another case that gained as much attention as the Ten Commandments, maybe more in some circles. Do you remember the case involving property in Connecticut, the eminent domain case? It came as a shock to many Americans when they discovered that the government, if they wanted to get more taxes from a property, could just choose to take that property and give it to someone else. Not without compensation, of course, but often that compensation isn't fair market value, despite what they claim. And a lot of Americans were concerned about this case, that your property rights could be taken away by the majority. Now, what was most interesting to me about this case was I've just described to you the right wing of the court, who seems to have no time for religious rights or civil liberties generally, and the left wing, left and center, who generally do have more time for civil liberties. Well, in this case, they were completely reversed. It was the Scalias and the Thomases who were up in arms saying, property rights are sacred, they're important, they need to be protected. And it was the left wing of the court who said that the majority could take away property rights. I was very puzzled by this. Why you'd think that if you cared about individual rights, property is just one of those other individual rights. What's going on here? And this last semester I studied 19th century America in my PhD program, and the scales fell from my eyes, and I realized there were deep historical roots that helped me understand that what is happening today is really the Second American Civil War, and it relates directly to what happened in the first 100 years of our nation's history, in the first Civil War. And it's important both for civil rights, black and white sorts of civil rights, racial civil rights, as well as our religious liberty. And I want to share some of this history with you this morning because it sets the foundation for what we will do next, our next program. You have to go back to the Constitution at the beginning. And I referenced this earlier. Many people don't understand that the Bill of Rights, in fact, I don't think I understand until I went to law school, that originally didn't relate to the state governments. The freedom of the press and freedom of speech and freedom of religion was only protected as against the federal government. So if the state of Tennessee or wherever wanted to shut your church down or censor your newspaper or not allow you to protest on the streets with signs, they could do it, and you had no recourse to the federal courts. We've become so accustomed to asserting our constitutional rights against any government intrusion that we've overlooked this, that originally wasn't that way. You only had it against the federal government. And there was a very good reason for this, and that was because the elephant in the room at the Continental Congress and the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia was slavery. And much of how the Constitution was formulated with a careful eye to not upsetting the balance of the slave trade. The Southern states just would not have entered any compact that they viewed as directly threatening their established institution and their way of life. And the Northerners, unfortunately, didn't have the moral courage at that time to draw the line in the sand. And we paid for their compromise 60 or 70 years later in a bloodbath. But this is what it was at the beginning, that their slavery, the word, wasn't in the Constitution. They avoided that. But they did have, of course, the three-fifth compromise, that slaves would be counted as three-fifths of a person for purposes of representation in Congress, as well as for purposes of taxation. And then there was a 20-year slave trade rule. Congress couldn't interfere with the slave trade for 20 years, but after 20 years could outlaw slave trade. Now, where did that leave the issue of slavery itself? Well, it was left ambiguous. The Northerners, with the expansive wording of the Declaration of Independence, said, well, we think, under the Constitution, protecting the general welfare, these amendments about protecting people and life, that we can outlaw it after this 20-year period. But the Southerners didn't think any such thing. And the Constitution was ambiguous enough that both sides had arguments that supported their points of view. But it was important for the Southerners to focus on property rights, and states' rights. They viewed the Constitution as kind of creating this protective shield for local majorities to be able to carry out their way of life, which effectively was holding slaves and keeping their cultural and social systems going. The Northerners viewed the central government as being more important than that, as being involved more in the citizens' lives, and had a view of the spirit of the law rather than the letter. So the Southerners were strong supporters of the phrase strict construction. If it's not there in the Constitution, you can't do it. It doesn't say you can free the slaves, therefore you can't. We're not going to read beyond the letter of the law. They viewed the states as sovereign, and of course the Civil War shows the Union believed in a strong Union. The Southerners viewed the Union was a confederacy of more important states, and that the states themselves could nullify acts of Congress if they didn't want to abide by them. And so these two views of the Constitution developed and grew stronger. One, that you were primarily a citizen of your local state, and the state would decide what rights and protections you have, whether you were a slave or free, whether you could practice your religion or not, whether you had free speech or not. The other view was that the federal government was more important, and you were a citizen of the federal government. And especially after the Second Great Awakening in the 1830s and 40s, out of which our church grew, that was largely responsible. The spiritual impulses from the Great Awakening fed into a number of reform movements, including the abolition movement, begins in about the 1830s, other reform movements closely tied to that, women's rights, women's voting rights. And interestingly enough, these same two groups of individuals were strongly involved in anti-Sunday law activities well before the Adventist Church was on the scene. And so you had this libertarian civil rights movement growing in the North that was saying no. And the first bogeyman to be knocked down, of course, was slavery. That was what was most pervasive and most in everyone's face and most threatening to civil liberty in America. Well, to cut a long story short, it was effectively this that led to the Civil War. It was two views of the Constitution that could not be reconciled. The ambiguity was there. The strength of feeling on both sides was there. And so there was a Civil War. And it's interesting, at the outset of the Civil War, the Confederacy wrote a constitution, and they said explicitly in that constitution, the states are sovereign, and this is merely a collection of states. And it came back to bite them. It was very hard to act in a concerted, unified fashion. It specifically protected slavery as an institution and prevented the outlawing of it. So they wrote the constitution in their image. The ambiguous one they turned into one that was clearly in favor of slavery. Well, the Northerners, they didn't need to write a new constitution. They read their constitution in light of the Declaration of Independence. And they said, we represent a nation that has said all men are created equal. And they read into that men, women as well. And that we can stand on this and we will fight for this. And the remarkable thing about the Civil War is that it was ever fought to begin with. It wasn't fought over land or money or resources, it was fought over a moral issue. I don't think we could have done that in the last 50 years. Even World War II, we entered because we were attacked. We didn't go on a great moral crusade just because we chose to. So the Civil War was a war, it was about slavery, clearly, but it was also about what kind of government, what kind of country we were. We were a collection of individual states, or were we a national government that had an interest in protecting the rights of national citizenship? And when we won, amendments were passed not just to outlaw slavery, but to protect the civil liberties of citizens, of all Americans everywhere. And there's a long, dry legal discussion I could go into and won't about how that was diverted, and there were some Supreme Court decisions in the 1870s and 1880s that read out and narrowed the language of the 14th Amendment so that it didn't apply the Bill of Rights to the states. But if you go back Thomas, Justice Thomas, is all concerned about original intent and whether the First Amendment should apply to the states. Well, he's only talking about the founders in Philadelphia in 1787 and 1789. The Civil War amendments had founders as well. And they got up on the floor of Congress and said, we want these 10 amendments to apply to all citizens in this country against all governments, including state governments. And that's what this amendment is about. And that's why the First Amendment applies against state governments today. And it was a conscious decision to take this principle of Protestantism that applied at the federal level and apply it at every level of our government. Now, Thomas, Justice Thomas, and others on the Supreme Court want to say strict construction, states' rights, we shouldn't have incorporation, this adding the amendments over time is not something our founders would have countenanced. They want to fight the Civil War over again, not with bullets and bombs, but with legal ideas and reinterpretations of the Constitution. And those of us that are concerned about the new Supreme Court Chief Justice, Justice Roberts and Alito, are concerned about their religious views, but we're also concerned about this notion that the federal government should no longer have a role, that everything should be turned back over to the states. Yes, the states are supposed to be laboratories of experimentation, but they're not supposed to be experimentations on our civil rights and our religious rights. And so at the heart of this judicial controversy lies a refighting of the first American Civil War about what kind of country we're going to be. And at the heart of that war lies the question of the Protestant character of our nation, whether there is going to be a national standard for the protection of civil liberties and civil rights, or whether local majorities will be able to choose, pick and choose what kind of rights and what extent you will appreciate those rights. Whose constitution was right? In the fight between the North and the South, we often say, secularists often say, might makes right, and the strongest side won, therefore its view of the Constitution won. But if you go back and you say, Lincoln at Gettysburg got it right. He said, 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth this nation. And if you sit down and calculate, where do 67 years take you? Do they take you to the Constitution of the United States? No, they don't. They take you back to the Declaration of Independence. And Lincoln recognized that they weren't fighting about the Constitution as such, they were fighting about the spirit of the Constitution, which he saw had been founded with the Declaration of Independence. And that was the guiding vision of America, that God had created all men equal. And it's recognized in the Constitution itself. If people talk about rights of privacy being made up, and I have right-wing friends who think that if it's not there in the Constitution, the separation of church and state, ask them about the Ninth Amendment. And they usually won't know what it is, but the Ninth Amendment is the amendment that says that rights found in the Constitution shall not be construed to deny other rights held by the people. So the Constitution itself recognizes that the people have rights that aren't specifically set out in the Constitution itself. And shouldn't the government respect those rights? It absolutely should. So the Constitution that the North, it was good that the North won, and in some ways the fact that the victors, they were able to bring out their vision of the Constitution, but they got it right. It was the vision that was set out in the Declaration of Independence and that the framers had in mind. But it's not just a legal or a constitutional question. It has to do with Protestantism, that second pillar that Ellen White referred to in the opening statement. The protest of the princes in 1529, in matters of conscience, the majority shall have no say. Protestantism isn't the right of the Protestant majority in this country to post their version of the Ten Commandments in public places or to enforce their views of God. Protestantism is the right of minorities to worship God as they feel convicted. The Civil War in this country had a North and a South to it, and we often talk of it in those terms, the North and the South. But as Adventists, we're familiar with another conflict that involves North and South. The book of Daniel talks about the king of the north and the king of the south. And I'm not suggesting that that's meant to represent the Union and the Confederacy, don't get me wrong, but it does represent a conflict that is taking place in our country, a cultural conflict between left and right that espouse principles that relate to this king of the north and the king of the south, the red states and the blue states. The cultural and the moral divide that we face in America was foreseen 2,500 years ago, and the Bible speaks to us on it. As we look at the wars that take place, the legal and the cultural wars, who do you feel more threatened by? Is it the left, who is proposing gay marriage, achieving it in some states, abortion on demand, wanting to protect pornography and pornographers, teaching evolution in the schools? Those are threats, very real. Or is it the right? Is it those who want to impose their moral views, who want to put prayer into schools, who want to take taxpayer funds and send them to religious institutions? As Adventists, we tend to be very conflicted because we care about the Ten Commandments. We care about morality. How can those on the left be right? And we are given what appears to be a choice between dual opposites. And most of America is being given a choice between dual opposites. And they think that the truth lies in one camp or another. But I'm here to tell you that it doesn't. And the story of the kings of the north, and the king of the north and the king of the south will bring this to light. And the pathway between the two is where Adventism lies and where our message for today lies. And in the next session, we're going to go into the identities of the king of the north and the king of the south to help explain this legal and cultural conflict and where our message fits in. So thank you for your time and for your attention. That brings this particular session, my formal presentation, to an end, and I've left some time for questions that I would be happy to try to answer. Yeah, that's a good question. The question was, what is the meaning or the ramification of having decisions based on the state level versus the federal level? And I should make it clear that I don't think all decision making should take place at the federal level. There's an enormous amount of stuff that has to happen, government stuff that has to happen at the local level. But often when you hear states' rights talked about, it's code language for allowing local majorities to have their way in matters of civil liberties and civil rights, and whether it be racial or religious. And ever since the 1930s and the rise of the regulatory state, there's a good argument that the federal government has become overly intrusive in various areas of life and the economy and regulation, and I think there are legitimate arguments to be made that the government should back out of certain areas. But those arguments get confused with government backing out of enforcing the Bill of Rights and the civil liberties of its citizens. And in the Civil War, it was decided that national citizenship was supremely important in this country, and that the civil rights of national citizens would be protected against all governments. And that is right and should happen. And insofar as states' rights language is used to detract from that, it's a bad thing. And it essentially, it's like the Southerners wanted: protect states in their ability to carry out the cultural and religious values of its majorities. Now that's maybe overstating it slightly, because there are state constitutions and some states have good civil liberties and civil rights. But down at the local level, there's less of a guarantee. State judges are often elected, so they are more affected by popular opinion, whereas the federal judiciary is much more able to protect minorities because they're more insulated from popular opinion. Mm-hmm. the question was, we are a religious country founded on religious beliefs, and if we take the Ten Commandments out, aren't we, and become a secular country, we're rejecting the principles that we were founded on. And that is a question that's often asked, and one that's attractive to Adventists. The problem is, with the question is, yes, we are a religious country, even a Christian country, because of the character of the people that founded it, not because of the formal government that we instituted. Most Americans were Christians at the founding. Most Americans are Christians today, Protestant Christians. But because they were Protestant Christians, they said, we are going to make a government that is neutral toward religious matters and that is not going to pick and choose sides in religious arguments. And that is what truly being a Protestant Christian country is about. Now, I will take your point in one regard, and not all my separationist friends agree with me on this. You remember the Pledge of Allegiance case, the phrase under God and the Pledge of Allegiance, should that be there or not? I'm not convinced that all references to God or the existence of a higher power by the government is absolutely an improper establishment of religion, because to accept that, you almost have to have an atheistic state, which is what Russia was. And an atheistic state can recognize no power higher than itself. And in fact, to have a limited government of any kind, there has to be a limitation that comes from somewhere. And in our country, our founders recognized a transcendence. James Madison said the definition of religion was the duty we owe to our Creator and our manner of discharging it. And clearly the government has no role in telling any of us how to relate to God or how to carry out that duty. But for the government merely to recognize that there is a higher power, as Christ told Pilate when Christ was before him, is merely to recognize limitations on government power. And I'm not convinced is establishing religion itself. But putting up the Ten Commandments, those are the duties we owe to God and our manner of discharging them. And Judge Roy Moore put up his 20-ton granite monument in his courthouse, and he had to choose which Ten Commandments he was going to put there, the Protestant version, the Catholic version, or the Jewish version. And it was the Catholic, it was some modification of all three, but it was primarily the Catholic version, I believe. But it certainly didn't talk about the seventh-day Sabbath. It was the Sabbath day. I don't want government officials writing the Ten Commandments for me and putting them up in public places. That's not their role. I pay my taxes and I vote and I elect them for other reasons. I'd like them to keep the Ten Commandments. That would be a nice thing. But they shouldn't be using government funds to decide which version and how they're going to be posted. Well, there's no statute of limitations, and I don't know if I referenced the Flag Salute case. It was a very important religious freedom case during World War I about the Jehovah's Witnesses not being compelled to salute the flag, a very important free speech and freedom of religion case that said they were protected in doing that. The surprising part of the story was that the identical case had come to the court 2 years earlier and had come out the other way. Couple of justices change their positions. So they can rehear a case almost immediately and come down differently. They don't like doing that. They value precedent, as the whole federal system does. If the Supreme Court kept changing its mind, you'd have chaos in the system. Nobody would be quite sure what the law would be. But usually what happens is you have subsequent cases that are slightly different that relate to the same principle. So there's a couple of cases coming up that will relate to Roe, but it's not about outlawing abortion entirely. It's about parental notification requirements and waiting limits. And so it's a question of, well, what did Roe really mean? How broad were its principles? What does it really require? So they'll come back and they'll continue to reinterpret Roe in light of changing circumstances and questions. But that's a good question. Stare decisis means you're bound by a previous decision, but you're not entirely bound by it. The court can overturn it, but it usually chooses to. It doesn't like overturning decisions. It wants to be guided by them rather than overturn them. Right. Right. Well, you know, that's why that. Well, you know, that's why that was the argument that countries made for having kings. You know, here's one supremely wise person who's going to be very efficient at protecting us. And we've made a different calculus. We're a republic. We believe that human nature tends towards the aggrandizement of power and the misuse of power, and we've said we are going to divide our government into three segments, that there will be a large representative group that makes the laws, and if the courts get it wrong, the legislative branch can overrule them, can overturn them, can help pass constitutional amendments if they need to. But the presidency is so powerful because the entire executive branch is invested in one individual. And so that individual has an amazing sway of power. And if he starts usurping the roles of the other two branches of government, you effectively have an imperial presidency. Representative democracy has become a sham. The Roman Republic continued its republican form for many, many years after the rise of the Caesars. They had a Senate for two centuries. It was a rubber stamp. It was a meaningless exercise. It was an imperium. It was no longer a republic. And I'm fearful that our nation is tending that direction. And it's not just something in the last couple of weeks. When the Congress handed the power to the president to declare war at some point in the future, they took, you know, one of the main prerogatives of the Congress. It's raising taxes and making war is something the people should have the ultimate decision in. And for them to hand it off in the manner that they did, I think, was the beginning of this incredible centralization of authority and power in the executive branch, which is always unhealthy for a country. Well, sure they were, and that's why we're not worried about it.
And to me, it's like, well, we're quote unquote not worried about it, but why should it just be them? Why isn't he eavesdropping on everybody? And he just takes a group to eavesdrop on. Yeah, granted, it was out of that group that
the terrorists arose. Well, I mean, and your point is well taken, because the biggest terrorist tragedy we had before 9/11 was a white Christian supremacist, Timothy McVeigh, and the government has limited resources and it has to target its resources at those it perceives to be a threat, and so it's chosen the Muslim community, which is understandable, but it's not a question about where the lines are being drawn. Perhaps these people needed to be surveilled or searched or whatever. But in a constitutional democracy, we have a system set up whereby those lines are drawn by the people who, the group that most represents the people, the Congress. And those are carried out by the executive branch, and it's checked against the Constitution by the judiciary. And what our concern is that this executive seems to be saying, we'll draw the lines, and we'll decide how to carry them out, and we'll decide whether they've gone too far. Well, you're just, in one stroke, undermining the essential republican essence of our government.
I have a question.
Well, lobbying groups are very active in Washington, and they have a tremendous amount of influence, and don't ever believe that your voice doesn't matter. You know, you think, well, I'm one letter or one email, but the way that they count these on Capitol Hill is that each letter they view as representing 200 people or 500 people, sometimes 1,000 people. So if you send an email, it has an effect that's disproportionate to just one email. And I'm here with a friend from Washington, James Standish, represents the church on Capitol Hill, and I worked with him when I was in Washington for a number of years, and he runs an email service that comes out every couple of weeks that updates people on church-state matters, what's happening in Congress, whether you should write an email at that time. It's all about timing. You just don't want to write things off into a vacuum. But at critical points in time, when there's a bill pending or a nomination being considered, he can alert you. And if you go to religiousliberty.info, there's a website that hosts a number of religious liberty concerns, and you can get information about the North American Religious Liberty Association, which is the Seventh-day Adventist sort of national group that lobbies and advocates on these issues. You can get signed up to be on an email list and to receive information about these topics, religiousliberty.info. And my Andrews University organization is connected with that. So we should probably break for a few minutes here. We'll have more questions next session, and we'll see you back in 15 minutes.
For additional CDs and audio cassettes of this message or for other presentations by these speakers and others associated with ACM, you may contact us as follows. In the United States and Canada, dial our toll-free order line, 800-233-4450. International calls, dial 717-652-7000. Fax orders, dial 717-652-9050. Our internet email address is info@americancassette.org. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. Our entire catalog is online, and we accept MasterCard, Visa, and Discover credit cards. Maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages since 1975, American Cassette Ministries, a 501c3 nonprofit ministry, is dependent upon your generous tax-deductible contributions in order to maintain our low prices and to continue providing you the finest genuine Adventist preaching until Jesus comes. He's coming soon.